Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The letter C can mean so many things in business. A C note, $100. C level, shorthand for executives with the word chief on their business cards. Also, C, the stock ticker for Citigroup. As of today, the latest bank wishing it had never heard the word subprime. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Tables, How to Eat Supper, a holiday gift idea for people who love to eat, now available at splendidtable.org. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Friday, everybody, the 14th of November. Great to have you here. If you have ever worked at a company in trouble, you know it's never a good thing when the boss calls an all-hands meeting. Welcome to Citigroup come 8 o'clock Monday morning. In a company-wide email today, CEO Vikram Pandit told employees he wants to talk about Citi's accomplishments since he took over almost a year ago. But it might be worth going back farther than that, to, say, 1995. Shares of Citigroup, one of the biggest banks in the world, closed today at a level not seen in 13 years. It has lost money four quarters running. 23,000 jobs have already been cut, with rumors of tens of thousands more coming. Also, a new tactic that might affect you even if you don't work there. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson explains now from New York.
Citigroup plans to start raising interest rates on credit cards for some of its customers. The move is intended to make up for a decline in credit card revenue due to fewer offers going out and smaller payments coming in. It's perfectly legal, but analysts say an interest rate hike of a few percentage points won't solve Citi's problems. Problems made worse because of where many of Citi's consumer deposits are.
One of the huge differences between Citibank and any other American bank is that most of Citibank's deposits are abroad.
Felix Salmon writes the finance blog at Portfolio.com.
That means they're not insured by the FDIC, and that means that the people who have money on deposit with Citibank have good reason to want to move that money somewhere safer.
And with an ever-tumbling stock price, Salmon says, a run on the bank becomes much more likely. That's why Citi's unsuccessful offer to buy Wachovia was such a big deal. Citi wanted more branches in the U.S. so it could hold more FDIC-insured deposits. Eileen Fahey is a managing director at Fitch Ratings. She says Citi is now at a competitive disadvantage because other U.S. banks have acquired their rivals.
All of those benefiting from larger deposit bases in the U.S., and Citigroup's been challenged on that front.
The challenges appear more dire by the day. A number of Citi's executives reportedly bought over a million shares of the company's stock yesterday. That wasn't enough to boost the value or investor confidence that Citi can rebound on its own. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Here's an economic indicator we all saw coming a mile away. Retail sales dropped off the edge last month, down 2.8% in October, according to the Commerce Department. That is the biggest monthly drop ever. But bad as it sounds, and it does, it's not just stores and car dealerships that are empty. We're spending less time shopping online, too. And Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports that could have some big internet companies searching for profits.
You know all that time-wasting internet window shopping employees do around the holidays? May not be such a problem this year. Consumers are so strapped, they're not even browsing for gifts, says industry analyst Rob Enderle. He says they're avoiding online stores altogether.
We haven't seen this sharper reduction in search and click-through behavior. Folks are trying to curtail their spending, and that means they're curtailing their shopping as well.
A recent report from Majestic Research found the number of websites Americans look at has fallen by about 6% since the spring. That could be bad news for companies like Google that rely on search-related advertising. Enderle points out advertisers usually pay for search ads only when consumers click on them, and if they click less often, the price of those ads could drop.
The reality here is it's not the eyeballs these advertisers are paying for, it's the pocketbooks. And as long as those pocketbooks remain empty, we're going to continue to have a problem.
Search advertising is a $30 billion business. It accounts for roughly half of all online advertising. And any setback could be temporary. As the recession drags on and companies redirect their marketing budgets, the pay-per-click ad model could become more attractive, says Daniel Taylor, an analyst with the Yankee Group.
As times get tight, marketers shift their budgets away from television and print, and they tend to focus on more direct response media that are more measurable.
Taylor says because frugal shoppers will spend more time picking out exactly what they want, search will become even more important. So the price per click could actually go up, and workers will be back to wasting time on the internet. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
Confirmation that the global economy is still up a creek is best reflected today in what you might call the limousine indicator. The streets of Washington, D.C. are crowded with motorcades. No, nothing to do with the presidential transition. 20 heads of state have come to the nation's capital for a rare face-to-face meeting. From Washington, Marketplace's John Dimsdale has more on plans to revamp the world's financial architecture.
First, the group will coordinate immediate help for banks and poor countries that have lost access to capital. Interest rate cuts, capital injections, even an International Monetary Fund rescue plan are on the table. This is no time to wait for President-elect Barack Obama to take office, says Fred Bergsten at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
It would not be desirable to wait even another 2 months to get going on some of the additional steps that need to be implemented now to strengthen the world economy.
The group's second priority is to start reforming global financial rules, established more than half a century ago at Bretton Woods, New Hampshire. But in the midst of a crisis and with 20 countries in the room, Stephen Schrage at the Center for Strategic and International Studies says they shouldn't reach too far.
The preparation has not been laid. This is not Bretton Woods, where it's years after the initial crisis or years and months in the planning. But setting too high a goals, I think, could cause problems.
Reformers are clamoring for oversight of the largely unregulated trade in derivatives, which include the now toxic mortgage-backed securities. David Chavern at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce favors an international clearinghouse to keep tabs on the complex financial instruments.
There's tremendous capital flowing to China and India and Indonesia and Brazil, and they have to be brought into the system one way or the other.
The summiteers know their work won't end this weekend. There's already talk of a follow-up meeting next spring. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The slumping economy has officially gone high-tech. Sun Microsystems announced deep layoffs today, 5,000 to 6,000 jobs, as much as 18% of its workforce. Add that to Citigroup, lousy retail sales, and you know what happened on Wall Street today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Hedge funds. You hear about them all the time, how they're these giant, mostly unregulated piles of investment capital that make rich people richer. In theory, it'd be great to get in on some of that action, right? Who doesn't like double-digit returns? But maybe it's just as well most of us can't, because once you're in a hedge fund, it's tough to get your money back out. After fund managers lock up your cash, you can really only get at it a couple of days a year. They're called redemption days. And thanks to the fallout from the financial crisis, there is a big one coming up tomorrow. Sally Herships reports.
You and I may not be able to invest in hedge funds, but our pension funds and endowments can, and they do. That was fine during the boom years when everything was going up and hedge funds made jaw-dropping returns. But now everything from stocks to soybeans is trading down, and hedge funds are losing money like everyone else. The average fund is down 15% this year. Chris Gatesy teaches finance at Wharton. He says the people and institutions who invest in hedge funds are spooked by the losses, and they want their money back.
An investor will call a fund of funds and say, look, I'm really scared. I want to go to cash. And the fund of funds manager says, well, okay, but I need to get the money first.
But that can take a while. Investors in stock and bond funds are used to getting their money back anytime they want it. Hedge funds don't play that way. Mark Fried is managing director for investment advisors Lister Watson. He buys shares of hedge funds. He says hedge funds are only loosely regulated, and they don't have to give investors their money back immediately, even when they're asked.
If our clients ask for their money back from us, we're caught in the middle a bit, because we will ask, but we may find out that some of the funds don't want to honor our requests.
That's because honoring those requests means selling assets, something hedge funds only like to do if they're making money on the deal. With the markets down, they're more likely to lose money if they sell now. Still, many investors want to cut their losses, and hedge funds say they're getting an unusually high number of redemption requests ahead of tomorrow's deadline. So many, says Chris Gatesy, that fund managers are calling it D-Day.
Spread out over a longer point of time, that kind of liquidity demand may not matter. But isolated at a point in time, in the short run, can matter a lot because you may see some fire sales.
As the economy deteriorates and the markets fall, the assets the hedge funds own are worth less and less. The more investors that ask for their money back, the more assets the hedge funds have to sell to raise that cash. And the more they sell, the more they push the price of everything down even further, including their own profits. Lister Watson's Mark Fried says this spiral of selling means everyone loses, whether they invested in hedge funds or not. He says many people and institutions didn't understand what they were getting into when they put money into hedge funds.
What people should understand about hedge funds is that they are not short-term trading vehicles.
Fried says hedge funds take risks that pay out over time. They often move against the market, buying when everyone else is selling. Wharton's Chris Gatesy says they want to buy now and make the most of a down market, but they're tearing their hair out because investors are forcing them to sell instead.
Now's the time that I'm finding the best investments of my lifetime, of an entire century, and now you're asking for money back.
Lister Watson's Mark Fried says hedge funds could lose about $600 billion this year, but that doesn't mean they're extinct. Yes, the average fund is down 15% so far since January, but the stock market is down double that. So for those investors with a strong stomach, hedge funds still look like a pretty good bet. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Time to put the weekly wrap on a busy 5 days. It seems like everything changed, from what the Treasury Department's going to do with the bailout money to whether or not Detroit is going to or ought to get any help. Here to help us figure it all out are David Leonhardt. He's a columnist for the New York Times. Lee Gallagher is with Fortune Magazine. Hello again, guys.
Hi, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
Let's start, Lee, with you and this very public about face that Henry Paulson made this week when he came out and says, you know what, on this bailout thing, I kind of changed my mind. Are you worried at all that the plan to save the global economy is in shaky hands?
Well, there's no doubt it was a huge 180. I mean, it was like, you know, it started out, we're going to sell widgets in Kansas, and then, wait a minute, now we're going to sell sheep in Florida. I mean, it was just a complete reversal. I think everybody would be in agreement here that we're dealing with uncharted waters and there is no roadmap. But nonetheless, I mean, the whole original bailout was sold that it not only has to be done this way, but it has to be done this way right now. And that just really didn't turn out to be true.
David, scary to you a little bit?
Absolutely. I mean, the main thing that really does not inspire confidence is that they didn't just not choose this plan originally. They were scornful of it. I mean, the Treasury Department and to some extent the Fed said, that's a bad idea. And weeks later, it's exactly what they're doing. And I think that the Bush administration has done some things right in responding to this crisis, but I also think they've been behind the curve a lot. And I think it's good news that we're going to have a new team coming in that might be able to establish a little bit more confidence in the markets.
Lee, let me ask you the consumer question. I mean, there are some technical aspects of this mess that seem to be getting better. The credit spreads are narrowing, and there is some indication that money is being lent. What about you and me and consumers? How is life being reflected out on Main Street?
You know, you're right. I mean, commercial paper rates have fallen a little bit. The LIBOR's fallen. But in terms of the consumer, things just really seem to be getting worse and worse and worse with every passing day. I mean, we're just seeing retail sales fall off a cliff. We're seeing chains go bankrupt like Circuit City this week. There will be more to come. We're looking at possibly the first December to have negative retail sales. People are, you know, really scared. People are losing their jobs. And it just creates a spiral, really.
David, let me pick up on that point about jobs. One of the industries lining up for bailout money is Detroit, of course. A lot of people say they should get it. A lot of people say they shouldn't. Where do you come down?
Well, I hate this, but I think that they probably need to get some amount of aid. And the reason I hate it is that it's really true that much of Detroit's problems are of its own making and of the making of its representatives in Congress who, thinking they've been protecting Detroit, have in fact been helping to seal their fate. And, you know, you see people from GM out there now saying, this isn't our fault, this is this broader crisis. But just take a look at last month's sales. GM sales were down 45%. 45%, but the average was 32%. And so what that tells you is that Detroit has really been doing something wrong. And if the feds, which is us, the taxpayers, are going to get involved, there need to be some really tough conditions put in, and they need to be conditions that acknowledge that these companies are going to get smaller. We just don't want tens of thousands of people thrown out of work right now, which would be both a human and an economic problem.
Lee, what do you say about that?
Well, I think David makes some really great points, but I do think that we're looking at the destruction of capital that's gone on in Detroit has been going on for decades. And to just sort of throw more money after that so they can kind of continue doing what they've been doing, that's a really tough sell, especially when, I mean, you know, bankruptcy sounds like a terrible option, but there's a real argument for that being the best solution. It would give these companies time. It would allow them to deal with their dealer network and the other issues that they face. I'm not saying that's definitely the answer, but there may be a case for it.
And I don't think, Kai, that's necessarily the wrong choice here. Bankruptcy might well be the best choice. The two things we want to avoid here are, one, throwing good money after bad, and two, suddenly having 20,000 auto workers out of work next month.
All right, you guys, thanks a lot. Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine, David Leonhardt at the New York Times.
Thanks, Kai.
Coming up, detoxing off our shopping high.
For the first time ever, we are realizing this is serious stuff. This time is almost like we got a slap on the chin. And when that slap on the chin is happening, and we know that from neuroscience, people wake up.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials gave back 3.8% today, 337 points to close at 8,497. The NASDAQ unloaded 5%, 79 points, ended at 1516. The S&P 500 dropped 4.1%, 38 points, finished at 873. For the week, ouch, the Dow sheared off 5%. The NASDAQ fell 7.9%. The S&P 500 forfeited 6.2%. That consumer clampdown on spending we told you about sent retail shares reeling. JCPenney marked down 10.4%. Then after the retailer reported its fifth straight quarterly loss, Macy's left behind 10.25%. Even Walmart was down 4% today, believe it or not. Tech stocks took a drubbing. Intel chipped off 7.75%. Cisco Systems left behind 3.75%. Sun Microsystems gained 1%. That on the news we told you about that it's cutting costs by laying off thousands of workers. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com. If it's happening in the world, it's being discussed on Gather. You can join the conversation at Gather.com. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert. Mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com. Let us do the work for you. Download Marketplace's After the Bell, a podcast which makes sense of a week's worth of business news. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve reports on industrial production for October. The Military Officers Association of America opens its annual meeting in Arlington, Virginia. And on November 17th, in the year 1800, Congress convened in Washington for the first time in its new home, the Capitol Building, still under construction. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Take that retail sales number from earlier in the broadcast, a record drop of almost 3% last month. Added to a microscopic uptick in consumer confidence, and what you get is a pretty solid case that we're all going to keep our wallets right there in our pockets. In an economy that's so dependent on you and me buying stuff, that's bad news. Or is it? Here's commentator Amity Schles.
Consumers rule the economic world. That idea comes from the father of modern economics, John Maynard Keynes. If consumers are grumpy, markets get sour. Politicians monitor consumers like hawks. And recovery It's all about the consumer, too. If the consumer is unhappy, the recovery won't come. That's why we have so many stimulus packages nowadays. Giving shoppers a little cash is supposed to be like giving espresso to the sleepy. They instantly perk up and shop. Then the stores turn around and buy more. Pretty soon, the economy is humming again. But maybe Keynes has it backwards. Maybe Washington does, too. Maybe it's good news that consumers aren't spending. It shows they wised up about all the bling. They're doing something better with their money, like saving it, putting it in the college fund, or investing it in companies that hire workers. That brings recovery, too. And after all, that espresso doesn't always work. It didn't last summer. President Bush's stimulus package failed to make people spend. They saved instead. That cautious behavior would have made sense to another economist, Milton Friedman. Friedman believed that consumers think in the long term. They don't spend on a moment's notice, even when caffeinated. They base their outlays on what they expect to earn over a lifetime. If the future starts to look darker, they keep the dollars in the wallet. Friedman's theory has a technical name, the permanent income hypothesis. But it's just common sense. People are thinking they may never get the price they once expected for that condo, at least not in their lifetime. And they could be right. So when those confidence numbers are low, remember, bad can be good. A wise consumer can be good for the economy. And as for recoveries, we'll take ours without the coffee.
Amity Schles is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. She's also the author of a book called The Forgotten Man. It's a history of the Great Depression. Send us your thoughts when you get a minute. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. When the economy slows, consumers predictably start changing their behavior, trying to be more thrifty and less impulsive. Just as predictably, stores change their tactics to try to get around those good intentions. Often they do it in ways we're not really aware of, not even at the physiological level. It's a technique called neuromarketing. In his new book, Buyology, that's B-U-Y-ology, marketing expert Martin Lindstrom explores what makes shoppers tick deep down. We met up at a new mall here in Los Angeles to find out how retailers hit and sometimes miss the mark.
We're just passing by the Barnes & Noble store right now. And it, as you can see, they have a nice island in there in the middle of the store promoting books. Now, does that work or not, do you think?
I don't know. I mean, I love books, so it works for me. Maybe not everybody, though.
Well, we did an experiment with chocolate. We offered women a box of chocolate with 30 pieces in it. We said to them, take as much as you want.
Yeah.
Guess what? They took one piece. Then we gave them a box of chocolates with only 6 pieces in it. We said, take as much as you want. They took 3 pieces. What we have learned is less is better than more.
When you did this study and this research, did you actually put people in MRI machines and do the brain scans?
We did, and we actually did it with a lot of people. We had in total 2,000 consumers' brains we were scanning across 5 countries, and we needed to use that in particular when it came to smoking, to subliminal advertising, and to the influence of our senses, because we know those factors are engraved into our brain, and we cannot verbalize it, so we had to use brain science to find out the answers.
This is about so much more than branding and consumer experience, isn't it?
It is. This is about our life. Because, you know, I just noticed when we met up, Kai, that you are holding a Starbucks coffee cup in your hand. Why do you do that?
Because I needed a cup of coffee. It's been a long day.
Yeah, and it's a ritual, right?
And you know what's funny is I walked by 2 or 3 other coffee places on the way to Starbucks.
But you bypassed them.
But I bought the Starbucks. Yeah.
So what's interesting is, first of all, it's a ritual. You walk to work, right, and you have to have it there. And I bet you, if you one day do not have that in your hand, guess what? Your whole morning is destroyed, right?
That is true.
Secondly, what's interesting is the tactile sensation you have on that cup. You know this little carbon they have around?
Yep.
In fact, we removed that for fun sometimes, and people did not feel the coffee was tasting as well anymore because the tactile sensation is programming our brain to think it tastes better.
So let's do the consumer advocate thing here and tell me how we as consumers can be smart to all this other than buying and reading your book.
Well, you know, I think number one point is skip the shopping trolley. No, I was in Woolworths the other day, and I've been into Whole Foods the other day. And those brands are actually increasing the size of the shopping baskets right now. In fact, Whole Foods basket is now double the size as it was last year. Do you know why? Mm. Because if it's double the size, you buy 30% more products. And you do that because you look down in this huge basket in Walmart, for example, and there's five products down there, and
right.
Oh, I haven't bought anything, right?
Right?
Well, guess what? You're actually buying much more.
Are all of these things, the signage and the false scarcity and the branding and all this neuroscience, are they enough to help retailers in the economy that this country and a lot of the rest of the world is in right now?
No, it's not. They will struggle no matter what, and we will see that this Christmas is probably going to be the worst in 24 years. And I think the main reason why is because for the first time ever, we are realizing this is serious stuff. This time is almost like we've got a slap on the chin. And when that slap on the chin is happening, and we know that from neuroscience, people wake up and they start to say, hey, I have to buy stuff differently. And what happens is people literally change stores. People literally change the path down the supermarket aisle. And they've never done that before. But that is the change we are facing right now. And retailers are realizing that.
Martin Lindstrom, his book is called Biology, The Truth and Lies of What We Buy. Martin, thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Martin and I spent 45 minutes walking around that mall, the Americana up in Glendale. It's way too long for the broadcast. So if you want to know, say, how the ritual of putting a slice of lime in Corona beer got its start, head to our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, playing off that big meeting in Washington this weekend that John Dimsdale was telling us about, the one that people are calling Bretton Woods 2. The original meeting, the one that set up the IMF and the World Bank, happened in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire. The town is still there. Times aren't so good, though. Mark Catalano is a local businessman.
We have closed two of our businesses for the month of November and half of December. And that's purely related to foot traffic right after Labor Day. It went down. The fall has been poor at best.
And here's your Friday afternoon marketplace moment of irony. The actual site of the Bretton Woods Conference, the Mount Washington Hotel, is a luxury resort right now. 17 years ago, though, its owners bought it from the FDIC in a bankruptcy auction. What goes around comes around, I suppose. That is Marketplace on this Friday afternoon from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 337 points, 3.8%. The NASDAQ fell 79 points, 5%. The S&P 500 dropped 38 points, 4.1% there. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste West, and the executive producer of the program is J.J. Yor. Coming up on Monday, making money on the mortgage mess.
There's a bailout out there. There's Wall Street firms and hedge funds that don't know what their product is priced at right now. They're going to need our help, all of those people.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.